This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
As I open Sesshin this morning, the beginning of this Rohatsu week, I asked us to consider what it is exactly we each think is the cause of our own unhappiness, and what would have to change, or could change in ourself or in our lives for us to be happy. And that, of course, is the basic question that Shakyamuni is said to have confronted, the cause and end of suffering. But it's important that we look at our own individual ideas about cause and end of suffering, and whether our own individual diagnosis is correct, and our fantasies of the solution are taking us in the direction we want to go, or whether they themselves are part of the problem. I thought I would go back to the story of Shakyamuni's life and enlightenment as it's very briefly told in the transmission of the lamp, which is the source book of case histories from which the koans of the Mumen Khan and the Blue Cliff Record are drawn. The information about Shakyamuni is very brief, really constitutes a mythology more than a history. But it's interesting just to look back at how the story is formulated, how the issues that he confronted are presented. It is said that the Buddha was the firstborn of a noble king's family, and that when the prince was 19 years of age, he decided to make some excursions from his home, wondering what he would see. In the course of taking walks to the four gates, he saw four things: an old man, a sick man, a dead man, and an ascetic, which deeply stirred him. And he said to himself, "Old age, sickness, and death must ultimately be rejected." Well, that's quite a remarkable statement. We're presented with a story of someone who grows up so sheltered that old age, sickness, and death are totally unknown to him until he's 19 years of age. And when he confronts them for the first time, he's appalled by their existence, really traumatized by their existence. It's really a picture of someone who has lived in such a bubble of such control and such luxury that the idea that there'd be things like old age, sickness, and death completely disturb his sense of self and the world. And his reaction is to say, these things must be rejected. You know, if you hear that now from somebody, you think they're psychotic. You know, it's like saying, I'm offended by the law of gravity. Entropy is just unacceptable. You know, these things must be rejected. Now, most people, of course, would feel that old age, sickness, and death are sources of pain and suffering that they'd like to avoid. But we would say most people are resigned to their existence and perhaps not genuinely accepting of them, in some way feeling unfairly afflicted or blaming themselves or life for these realities. And so the average person, while they may resign themselves to these sources of suffering, do not necessarily thoroughly penetrate into the nature of them, particularly in the sense that how totally inseparable they are from our lives. I think that we naturally see these things as obstacles or intrusions in our life, not our life itself. And perhaps it takes someone who's been totally sheltered in this kind of way as a prince to see them, you know, as complete intrusions that have to be banished. I have to do something about this. So the result of that, following night he has a vision in which a heavenly being named Pure Dwelling appears at his window, salutes him and says, "The time for your renunciation is at hand. You must leave your home." And hearing this, the prince was overwhelmed with joy, crossed the boundaries of the castle to seek the way of freedom from suffering. And again, the notable thing here is that the freedom from suffering is presumed to lie in renunciation and home leaving. That the problems of suffering are tied up with having relationships, having families, having people you care about, having a body that's vulnerable, having a body that can get sick, age and die, and somehow renunciation is going to be presumed to be the path of coming to terms with these things. And it's said, for 3 years he followed one teacher and studied the samadhi of non-action, but found it no good and gave it up. Then the next 3 years, he followed another teacher and studied the samadhi of non-thinking, but that too was no good and he gave it up. And then he went to the mountains and spent 6 years practicing ascetic disciplines together with many heretics, wearing sackcloth and eating nothing but a little rye each day. So that the picture we have here is of someone trying to, however we understand these practices, develop techniques of total control over mind and body, and through asceticism mortify the body so that it is in some way we will become impervious to its condition. I think that if we transpose this into a modern day scenario, our fantasies of control don't take people down the path of mortification so much as the path of the pursuit of health and well-being, that they will get their body into such perfect shape that it will not be subject to old age, sickness, and death. We'll escape it through health rather than through mortification, which is probably a better route, but is still a fantasy of control that is doomed to fail. Finally, after 12 years of these practices, it is said that sitting alone at dawn, seeing the morning star arose, the Bodhisattva became a Buddha. He was 30 years old. In other versions of the story, he is said to have proclaimed, "At this moment, I, the earth, and all beings together attain the way." So it is naturally a question for everybody who does this practice as to what happened when he saw the star on that morning. What changed? What was the nature of his insight? And I think we all come to our own versions of that answer, depending on our own experience. But one of the ways I've understood it over the years is that I picture him having engaged in the most extreme practices of his time, of control of his body, of his thoughts, mortification of the flesh, just gone to every extreme imaginable. And still none of these things brought him peace. And in some state of having given up on all of those things, he sits there and sees the star. And in a moment realizes that he and the star and everything share a kind of perfection that is not dependent on changing or perfecting or escaping anything at all. That star has not been practicing anything to perfect itself. That star has not failed to be a good enough star up until then. And the whole world at once attains the way, attains the sense that the world is just what it is. The world is not in need of fixing or perfecting. The way he has been trying to do to himself for all these years. And I'm imagining that in that moment he realizes that old age, sickness, and death are themselves in their own strange way part of the perfection of life. That they are what life is. The way twinkling is what a star is. The twinkling is the constant change of a star. Its display of impermanence moment after moment. And impermanence is not a flaw in life. Impermanence is the nature of life itself. And so that having gone from feeling that these things must be rejected, he comes around to seeing them as things that are, that must in some sense be embraced, or at least not made separate from oneself. Now, I'd like to imagine that if only his insight had been just a little bit deeper, he might have realized that attachment is part of life, just like old age, sickness, and death. And maybe he would have gotten up then and gone back to his wife and son. He might not have had to feel like whatever he achieved only came within the realm of renunciation and non-attachment, as if attachment is still something to be repudiated. And we, in the traditions of our practice, bear the legacy of this idea that non-attachment is an essential part of his realization. Now, this is true when we understand non-attachment as non-resistance to impermanence. When we understand that the attempt to control the uncontrollable is the source of our suffering. And yet, it conflates that attempt to control or hold back impermanence with the very ordinary and human need for personal love and relationship and security, as if these things, by their very nature, are going to go against the grain of the universe, or go against the grain of enlightenment, and that we can only truly realize non-attachment in the company of other men. There's a very strong implication that as soon as women are let into the picture, we're going to be enthralled to desire or dependency or vulnerability. And we have a kind of legacy in which the traditional monastic sangha becomes a lot like the experience of men who go through the army together, or a sports team together, or climb a mountain together. The bond of the men going through an ordeal where they feel a commonality and a shared project and an intimacy that somehow they never feel or are allowed to feel back home. And we're left with the paradox of the intimacy of the Sangha relationships to one's fellow monks and one's teacher being a very valorized form of connection, but connection to one's family or to a romantic partner being a defilement. This is a bit of historical and cultural baggage that I think we're gradually trying to question as we take a more psychological-minded approach to practice. As we try to learn from the example or the myth of Shakyamuni, we try to understand the nature of his insight and direct our own practice in that way. I think we need to try to restore our acceptance as a part of life of attachment, in the way we restore an acceptance of old age, sickness, and death, not as something that we have to begrudgingly put up with or resign ourselves to, but as fundamental to what it is to be human. It's a narcissistic dream of a godlike transcendence, that I will not need anything and I will not be vulnerable to anything. My body will not be subject to decay, and my emotional life will not be subject to dependency on other people. There's a kind of persistent fantasy of invulnerability and autonomy that is almost universally conflated with the spiritual. What we have to do is restore our acceptance of our dependency and our vulnerability. See through our fantasies of independence and invulnerability, and allow ourselves to awaken to being human. And as human, like that star, perfect as we are.